Welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley speaking to you from Washington, D.C. The big news this week, the descent into the maelstrom of fascist violence piloted by the goon and thug Donald Trump and his crazed petty bourgeois followers, not as numerous as you think. Remember that Trump is, as of I think last week, was running behind McCain in 2008 at the similar point in the primary process, even behind Romney. He may be actually running behind Bob Dole. And nevertheless, we're told that this mere plurality candidate is somehow the inevitable dictator of the United States. Well, we say no way. The American people are expressing their traditional revulsion against fascism. This is the only country in the world of the big ones that did not become fascist, did not appease fascism, meaning ally more or less openly, being at the Chamberlain-Daladier appeasement support of fascism or the unfortunate Molotov-Ribbentrop, rather more open support of fascism. And we've never had a fascist government, right? We had plenty of reactionary ones, don't get me wrong, plenty of reactionary governments, but never a fascist government. One of the deepest of all American cultural traditions is the disgust and revulsion with the fascist demagogue, the gesticulating vermin that appear on the stage from time to time. We actually have some interesting parallels on this. So what do we have? Well, the big news this week, His Majesty Trump threatens riots. He basically says, I demand a coronation. I am the great and powerful Trump, and I demand a coronation. And if you don't give me the coronation, there will be riots. Okay, Loretta Lynch, where are you, Loretta Lynch? Get the Rap Brown Law out, the Rap Brown Law of the late 60s, which says if you cross a state line with the explicit intent of inciting to riot, that's a federal crime. Into the clink, Leavenworth for Trump. And we even had an honest sheriff, at least honest up to a point, in North Carolina, who actually did do a review and see if Trump had fulfilled the necessary points for inciting to riot in North Carolina. Unfortunately, the sheriff involved had to conclude that he had not fulfilled the necessary prerequisites to be charged under the North Carolina law. But there's the federal law, which is what we are pointing to. So Trump is talking riots, and obviously the Trump camp has been whining all week. Boy, I can understand fascists, but I can't understand a whining, cringing little fascist, right? Always carping. They're complaining that the big bad students of the University of Illinois, with a certain, you know, certain inputs from MoveOn.org, from Black Lives Matter, or even from the Bernie campaign. I wouldn't say from Bernie. You look at Bernie, he is as frightened as a mouse. He doesn't want to be associated with that. You look at Tad Devine and tell me if that's a revolutionary, right? Somebody who won't even demand a vote recount. No recount demanded in Iowa. No recount demanded in Missouri now. So that's our fire-eating revolutionary. That's the new Lenin of the left wing of the Democratic Party. I'm sorry, it won't work. But Trump is nevertheless whining that his Chicago event was shut down. We've got top libertarians who are whining that poor Bernie has been able to launch the forces of international communism against the upright and edifying Donald Trump. This is all absolute baloney. Trump threatens he has no language except force and the threat of force, and above all the threats. So we would look at this and say, well, Trump threatens riots if he doesn't get his way at the convention. We'll look at this in a second. And he also threatens to send his goons, his violent, crazed, petty bourgeois geek act forces to Bernie's events. Well, if he's threatening with riots and with breaking up other people's rallies, right? This typical fascism, right? Remember in Italy in the 1920s, Germany in the 1930s, the idea was you'd send out your goons, right? Your squadristi, your Sturmabteilung, your stormtroopers, and you would then break into the opposition party, you'd destroy their offices, their card files, all this stuff. And then you'd go on to their newspaper and you'd burn that place and you'd make sure you smash the printing press. This is the kind of stuff we're going to get to see if Trump escalates according to the pattern up to now. But the other question is that if Trump says mass strike, well, if Trump says attack goon squad attacks, we say mass strike. We say there ought to be a mass strike against Trump. There ought to be a general strike against Trump. The policy of the Tax Wall Street Party, and my own personally, is that it is important now to oppose fascism, to make sure that it be ostracized, isolated, that people understand that fascism is not presentable. It is not a fixture of polite society. It has to be understood as people who have put themselves outside the pale of civilization and who are therefore no longer suitable interlocutors. Very interesting question about whether there should be debates with somebody like Trump. You could argue that both ways. But the idea is that wherever there are protests against Trump, we do not propose to leave those to Soros or anybody of that ilk. We're going to try to be there, and we're going to try to provide leadership. Then that means program, strategy, organization, and indeed some leadership, because all of that adds up to leadership. The principal question right now is Trump simply a racist, or is it more appropriate to call him a fascist, a Nazi fascist, or something of this kind? Now, racism, of course, is a terrible thing, and it's a very strong charge. But in American history, and as we look around ourselves, there are lots of racists, right? Racism is not exactly a state of emergency in the sense that it is structural and has been around. But fascism, as I've tried to explain, is something qualitatively new in this form. In other words, this is the most widespread, the most robust form of fascism. Although we can go back in the 1930s and find similar things, they don't seem to be, you know, threatening to take over one of the major parties. So it seems to me that the state of emergency is better conveyed by fascist or something along these lines. And of course, fascism or Nazism, even more pointedly, subsumes all kinds of racism. In other words, once you're a Nazi, you are racist from the word go. So this is the question. Now, to make this very concrete, we have AIPAC. We have the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, right? The what can we call it? The Sharon Netanyahu lobby meeting here in Washington on Monday, and there's going to be a protest because Trump is coming there. So it's a great chance to protest Trump and really say to those AIPAC people, you know, we know who you are, but this is really something you should not do even in your own interest. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Remember that everything you need to know can be found quite conveniently at Tarpley.net, Tarpley.net, and that includes all of my books, and it also gives you a chance to subscribe to a daily briefing, which I am very proud of, which I write for, I contribute, and which I would like everybody to read. So you should subscribe to it. It's very easy to do. It's all free. And with that, you're in touch with all of these tremendously important things and gotten some accolades from some influential people. The famous talk show host Lionel is an avid reader, and there are others. Right? Some want to be known, some not. But that's what you can find at tarpley.net. Now, here's the thing. What we're doing is saying, with that policy of the Tax Wall Street Party, that wherever these protests occur, we want to be there to inject those elements of ideological and moral clarity, of leadership, structure, organization, a strategy. How do you defeat Trump? All these things. Where are the authoritative people in the TV networks? Who's out there saying that Trump is a fascist? And you can't just sit down with Trump representatives in a talk show salon. You can't just sit down and pretend that these are normal people. They're not normal. This is not American, right? These people have to be considered pariahs. Again, they've got to be ostracized. They're going to say the first question ought to be, why are you a fascist? Or why is your man, why are you supporting this guy Trump, who is a fascist, and so on down the line, right? Because otherwise you're lying to people. You're hiding a very, very relevant fact. And since history is really no longer taught in any effective way, there are a lot of people who don't get it, but there's some who do. Let me point out one of them right away, right? Gold is where you find it. George Clooney has said now that Trump is a xenophobic fascist. I get the impression that he saw the success of the comedian Louis C.K. When Louis C.K. said something similar about Trump, he got himself on the front page of the New York Daily News. And this is all to the good. We welcome all of it. We need more of it. So we need the authoritative guardians of public morality, the churches, clergymen, the networks, the TV networks, cable networks. We need the principal newspapers and magazines. We need public intellectuals of all kinds, right? Law professors, stuff like this. We want them out there saying, stop Trump. He's a fascist. Now, who's doing it? Gold is absolutely where you find it, and anybody who does this deserves a vote of thanks. Now, here's the thing. I mentioned this question of AIPAC. It's going to be on Monday evening. Monday evening, and let's see what that means in terms of dates. We're talking the 21st of March. March 21st, that's Monday evening. And the protest is going to be against AIPAC. It's going to be at the Washington Convention Center, as far as I know. Do check tarpley.net. I'll put up a notice about this. You can also find it at the Tax Wall Street Party website. But people should come, and they should join in this peaceful protest with a permit. You're protesting Trump. He should not be received by AIPAC or by anybody else. He should be ostracized. He should be kept out. He should not be given the respectability of this. Now, who's doing the protest? Very interesting. A group of rabbis, a group of Jewish religious leaders. So we have Rabbi David Paskin, P-A-S-K-I-N, and Rabbi Jesse Olitzky, O-L-I-T-Z-K-Y, and they call their effort Come Together Against Hate. And this is because the title of this event is Come Together. That's what AIPAC calls it. These rabbis, with a strong basis in theology, morality, and tradition, say, let's come together against hate. So they have a Facebook, they have a website, and they say, this is not about policies. This is not about parties. This is about one particular person, Donald Trump, who has encouraged and incited violence at his campaign rallies. We are against the hatred, the incitement of hatred, and the ugliness that has engulfed this political season. All right. Now, it's a group of 300 rabbis, cantors, Jewish voters, Jewish professionals, others. And they're there to signal their rejection of Trump on Monday. And a lot of them are going to be at AIPAC, again, the Washington Convention Center. We have the Union for Reform Judaism, representing the largest Jewish denomination in America, in the United States, has put out a statement attacking Trump. And they write, at every turn, Mr. Trump has chosen to take the low road, sowing seeds of hatred and division in our body politic, writes the Union of Reformed Judaism. Now, the American Jewish Committee, different organization, their approach is a little bit different. They do not name Trump by name, but they protest against presidential campaign violence. Now, this is also quite interesting. Quote, we do not draw analogies to the rise of communism and fascism lightly, but both of those tyrannical movements rose to power, replacing democratically elected governments by virtue of threats of or actual violence against their opponents. Now, if we could just put these together, right? That the guy is Trump, and the direct analogy is the rise of fascism in the 1920s, and indeed of Nazism in the 1930s. Paskin argues that Jewish scripture is the opposite of Trump, that the stress is on love and decency. We're hoping thousands of people join us in that protest. We're going to be providing the antidote, we believe, to what Donald Trump is espousing. And I think we also have J Street, right? The kind of alternative to AIPAC. J Street put out a statement yesterday, Thursday, saying these factors going through Trump has attacked immigrants, attacked women, refugees, and so forth. These factors, in our view, render Donald Trump unfit to be the president of the United States. And they say Trump and his campaign, comma, driven by racism and hate, comma, beyond the bounds of acceptability, the vast majority of Jewish Americans, and should be of all Americans. So back in a minute on World Crisis. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. So, naturally, based on all that, how about it? Mainline Protestant denominations, where are you? Hey, you Episcopalians. Hey, you Methodists. Hey, you Congregationalists. Hey, all of these groups. How come you don't get out there, too, and denounce Trump? I'd be happy if people are aware of such statements. I haven't seen them. And then, in particular, I would turn to the Roman Catholic bishops of the United States, right? The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Where are you on this? Let's have a statement condemning Trump. Don't make the mistake that was made in the 1930s in particular. I'm afraid Pius the 12th in particular needed to be more vehement and explicit in rejecting Nazism and fascism. Don't set yourself up for that again. So Roman Catholic bishops of the United States come out with a statement about this, right? You're supposed to be concerned about the plight of immigrants. And I would call on the Pope, His Holiness Pope Francis. How about it? You've got to get into this, right? You've said that he's not a Christian. Maybe we could go a little bit further. Obviously, the fact that he said that the Pope has said that Trump is not a Christian, that ought to be the basis of something more on the part of the Catholic bishops, who are traditionally concerned about the plight of immigrants and ought to show that now in action. Okay, so all of that comes to the fore on Monday evening. Now, remember, we, the Tax Wall Street Party, took the lead already last Thursday in essentially providing the best content that was seen at the Miami Republican debate, right? Our Miami local did a wonderful intervention with that excellent poster with Trump, and then Trump equals Nazi. And you will see that. You should come and come to the, I guess it's the Washington Convention Center on Monday evening. Check exact place and time on Tarpley.net and TWSP.us, and you will see where we are. Come join us under that Trump, anti-Trump poster. Now, we've got a bunch of things going on, right? We know that there are plutocrats in the Republican Party, right? Party oligarchs, known as the establishment, who are fighting Trump. And we celebrate this because, as we've repeated consistently, when evil fights evil, that is when the good can benefit. And if we have Eric Erickson and his group meeting in Washington over the last couple of days and then putting out a statement, you can get the essence of it on Tarpley.net. Right? You can read that in the daily briefing of today, right, of Friday. Eric Erickson and his group are going to try to stop Trump. We have the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, right? Not one of our favorite people, right? He's an austerity ghoul and all that, but he is fighting Trump to some extent. He says that he is now studying the question of an open convention, exactly how that works. Right? These have not been seen for many, many decades. So Paul Ryan is talking about an open convention. It seems to be that he's trying to find ways to deny Trump the nomination, which is the obvious thing to do. We've also got Mitch McConnell, even lower on our totem pole. But nevertheless, he says to Trump, look, make sure you distance yourself from violence no matter who starts it. Get it? Otherwise, you will be blamed, and he will be blamed because he is the one who has brought in first verbal violence and then physical violence, right? We've seen all of this. He says, Trump is saying, I remember the good old days when people like you would go out on a stretcher, or I would like to punch you in the nose, or get them out, sick them, and so forth. So unprecedented and very unpresidential stuff. And then we have Ben Sasse, the senator from Nebraska. We have exposed him quite thoroughly in the past, but he now says he will lead a third-party split at the Republican convention and after it if Trump gets the nomination. Now, that you can know what that looks like, right? In 1860, the Democratic Party in 1860 met in Charleston, South Carolina, and they could not agree. They went through, 150 ballots. So then they said, okay, we're going to adjourn to Baltimore, Maryland, a month later. And there, under the chairmanship of Caleb Cushing, the king of the doughfaces, right, the king of the northern agents of slavery and secessionism, they did nominate Stephen Douglas for the northern Democrats. But then there was an immediate walkout by the Southern Democrats, and they met, elsewhere in Baltimore, and they nominated then Breckinridge, the Southern secessionist candidate. Breckinridge later, of course, became a Confederate general. He was the one who surrendered to Sherman in North Carolina after Appomattox, after the Lincoln assassination. So that's the idea. I wonder if Sasse has got a place rented, in other words, an alternative hall in Cleveland, so that he can just move his people across town and then set up the third party challenge. Structurally, we might say geometrically, the question is this. If Trump does not get 1,237 votes on the first ballot, well, then you go to a second ballot, right? The rules and simply the logic of a convention is you need to get an absolute majority, 50% plus one. You can't have somebody with a minority of the delegates demanding to walk away with the nomination and threatening riots if that is not done. So you go to a second ballot. The trick is on the second ballot. You can read this in the New York Times or else. Won't go through all the arcane stuff. But the idea is that once you get to the second ballot, a very significant part of the mass of delegates, I think about 40%, become free to vote their conscience. Now, conscience is another way to say bribery, I guess. Cajoling, threatening, bribing. So these are people who are generally appointed by state party chairs, county party chairs. You'll notice 4 years ago, a lot of these libertarians who are now joining Trump, they're screaming bloody murder. They were applauding this when Ron Paul had his myrmidons go into these state conventions and take more delegates than he was entitled to have. This is simply the way it works. So it means that if these delegates are bound by the primary caucus or state convention to vote, say, for Trump on the first ballot, when you get to the second ballot, they are no longer bound. They can vote their, quote, conscience, unquote. Now, what Trump is demanding is to say only one ballot and whoever gets a plurality, in other words, whoever gets a relative majority, not 1-2-3-7, but 1-1-2-0 or something, right? 100 or 200 votes short, if that's what it comes to. He's saying, stop the voting and give it to Trump. What are you going to say? No second ballot? No third ballot? Come on. We've had conventions that have gone to 150 ballots. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So our scenario is, with Trump, he says that if he doesn't get 1-2-3-7... normally, you'd go to a second ballot. He says, oh, no, you can't do that to me and let those delegates vote their consciences. Oh, no. We've got to stop the voting. We've shut the process down and have the coronation of Trump, the triumph of the will. Notice Trump's answer to every crisis is himself, his magnetic personality, his magical powers, his determination, right? His steely eye, courage, all this other stuff. A lot of baloney in reality, right? So he's saying, don't have any more votes, right? No more ballots. Shut down the voting. Trump is to be proclaimed, I guess, by acclamation. But by acclamation only works if everybody more or less agrees, and they won't. So that's one alternative. He's going to demand it. Now, if he doesn't get the nomination, then he's going to go out and say, bring riots into the streets, okay? Keep the Rap Brown law ready, because if he calls for violent demonstrations, he will be committing a federal crime directly inciting violence under the Rap Brown law. Hey, Loretta Lynch, have you ever heard of that one? And the rest of you guys at Maine Justice. Now, the other one is, suppose Trump gets the 1,237 on the first ballot. He is then the nominee. I don't see anywhere around that. Then we get the Napoleon in Moscow effect. So remember that in 1812, Napoleon captured Moscow. And as soon as he got to Moscow, fires broke out all over the city. The Russian military and other forces had decided to burn the city. And Napoleon did not know what to do. He dithered for about 6 weeks. He was very much afraid of getting trapped in a burned out ruin for the severe Russian winter. So he began retreating. He had to retreat on the northern route. His army then began to disintegrate, and he got into a stagecoach and just got out of there as fast as he possibly could, so that the Grand Army was actually destroyed. So that's the idea. You can take the Republican nomination, but it's going to be a burned out hulk. It's going to be a ruin. It's going to be of no political importance because a lot of people will have defected. All kinds of traditional Republicans, traditional reactionaries, Buckleyites, even some honest Austrians, if there were people like that of the von Hayek and von Mises school, they're going to say, no, 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 I'm not going to vote for that guy. Because remember, you're going to be a racist? You're going to be a fascist? No, no, no. That's impossible. That's the kiss of death. A lot of office holders are not going to want to go down that road, right? A lot of people from the Senate, the House, and so forth. So at this point, Ben Sasse, with his strange religious confederation behind him, will get up and say, no, we can have a third party. And a lot of people will simply go home. They'll just sit it out. They will not vote. They won't contribute to Trump. They won't go out and ring doorbells for Trump or man phone banks for Trump. Trump is going to be left with his crazed, petty bourgeois base, right? The people that have been losing. And they, whether they have the stamina to do this kind of stuff, right? These are people who, so far, you can see Trump does better in primaries than he does in caucuses. Because a lot of these heroes of petty bourgeois craziness, they won't stay for the length of time you need to do the caucus. Now, interesting commentary from John Podoretz, right? One of the sons of the great neocon Podoretz, right? Along with Crystal and so forth. These are the founders of the modern neocon group. So Podoretz writes for the New York Post and also Commentary Magazine. So his thesis is Trump says, I want to make America great again. And these people say, yeah, that's what he says, but that's a dog whistle. What his followers hear is, I'm going to find you a scapegoat. I'm going to find you a group that will be suitable for scapegoating and suitable object of punishment. In other words, take the crash of 2008, take the foreclosures, take the job losses, take the ruined lives, and pin that on somebody, the Mexican immigrants, right? The wetbacks, as I'm sure they're going to say. So then blame them. And that has gotten the goat of Rush Limbaugh, who has been talking about it. This is how I heard about it. So you get the idea. All kinds of discussions. Now, again, what I want to see is this stuff should converge on the parallels to the 1930s. And that's what you have to do, the 20s and the 30s. And it doesn't look like Podoretz takes it where it needs to go, which is that if you look at Hitler, right, the scapegoating of certain ethnic groups for the defeat in World War One, for the depression of 1929, for the inflation of 1923, that simply shows the close relation of Trump with his predecessors. Then, of course, there's comic relief. Ben Carson, who always appeared to be mentally unstable, right, not all there. There is a news item, I don't know if it's spurious, but that Ben Carson has been appointed the dean of the Trump University Medical School. I think that may be arcana, right? That may be just somebody's idea of a joke, right? Maybe April Fool's Day a little bit early, perhaps. Anyway, let's just take a look at the Democratic side very briefly. Bernie Sanders, is he a dead duck or not? Now, I don't think he is. There are some chances. Here's what the New York Times had to say. I would headline this, if Bernie could fight, he could still win quite a few states. Right? So here's from the New York Times. Bernie got pounded in the South, right? Hillary Clinton's lead is largely based on essentially the Confederate States of America, places where the Democratic Party cannot win the state in a general election, but where Hillary was able to win the primaries. Obviously, Hillary had studied what Obama did in 2008, right? A lot of, you know, remember a lot of Obama's support came from places like the Alaska Democratic primary or the Wyoming Democratic caucus, whatever they were. Places that you can't win, but where you can get delegates because of the arcane rules of the party. So, Here's the idea. Bernie would need to get 58% of the delegates from now on. Now, in caucus states, he has a chance. And this is, some of these are precisely these places that, the Democrats will never win in the general. So the Idaho Democratic Caucus, the Alaska Democratic Caucus, the Hawaii Democratic Caucus, Washington State Democratic Caucus, and Wyoming Democratic Caucus, minorities. There's a Utah primary. They'll never take that state, I don't think, but you can get some delegates. So if Bernie wins all of those, there are 216 delegates at stake in those places. If Bernie can beat Hillary 2-1, he can pick up 65 or 70 delegates. After that, we go on to Wisconsin and Arizona. These are places where he would have to win quite convincingly. Can he do it? Well, if he wanted to fight, he could, I would say, but that's precisely the issue. So far, he hasn't wanted to do it. Then it's North Dakota, Oregon, Montana. Bernie would have a chance in these places. In West Virginia, in Kentucky, in New Mexico, also a chance. Bernie might do well in Puerto Rico and Guam, but we don't know because there's no polling. And then come the big ones, California, New York, New Jersey, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, and the District of Columbia. You can see it's a tough row to hoe for Bernie. The big issue is, will he fight? And so far, the answer has been essentially not really. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to the second hour of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Topley in Washington, D.C. Now, a special treat and honor for us. We're going to go to Damascus, Syria, and talk to Thierry Meyssan. And the big question, of course, is President Putin of Russia has announced the withdrawal of a significant part of the Russian Air Force contingent from Syria, and many of them have already returned to Moscow. And the big question, of course, everybody wonders what is going on. Putin keeps everybody guessing. So I think we're going to get an exclusive and authoritative view from Thierry. So Thierry, welcome. Please tell us what is behind this announcement.
Yes, hello, Webster. According to the U.S. and European press, the decision of President Obama was a surprise for the Syrian leader. Of course, this is totally untrue. The decision of the withdrawal of the Russian troops was taken the 6th January. In fact, you know that they arrived at the end of September 2015, and they said they will have a bombing campaign until the Orthodox Christmas, until the 6th January 2016.
Correct.
But because, yes, but because of the complicated political situation at Geneva, they decide to continue this bombing until the Geneva conference will restart. So this is what happened the 15th March. That's why, according to this agreement, they announced the day before, the 14th March, they will withdraw from Syria. But all the leaders in Syria know the things 2 weeks before. 2 weeks before. And also, all the Russian soldiers here in Syria were aware of the withdrawal 2 weeks ago. To make this withdrawal, the Russian army need to use a lot of very big Antonov planes to transport all the materials they have. And they give to the international authority the plane of the flights 4 days before the announcement by Vladimir Putin. So it is very clear, everybody in the world who has to know the things know it before. And you can read in Defense News a report the Minister of Defense of Russia and the Chief of Staff of Syria in January in Moscow. So there is absolutely no surprise in such decision, and such decision is not a reaction to any problem between Syria and Russia, as you can read in some European and U.S. papers. Mm-hmm. But you have also to know that about 2 or 3 weeks ago, President Obama and President Putin decide together what they will do after that. And they decide together to ousted President Erdogan from Turkey. Right now, when we are talking, you have weapons coming from both from Russia and from the United States who are entering inside Turkey to support the PKK against Erdogan. So in the next month, not immediately, but in the next month, you will see the end of the war in Syria, except in the eastern part, Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor. But you will have the liberation of Idlib, Aleppo, all Palmyra, all the Greek cities, and you will have the beginning of a civil war inside Turkey. So this is exactly the contrary but what you are now reading in the Western press. And this news is now making a big alliance with Turkey. You know, they signed today an agreement and the European Union will give 3 billion of euro each year, not for a long time, but each year to Turkey to stop the migration of people. And European Union is accelerating the negotiation for the entrance of Turkey inside the European Union. They agree to stop the visa for the Turkish people. For the Turkish people don't need more visa to enter inside the European Union. And they will be totally blind about the installation of dictatorship inside Turkey. You know that since few months, President Erdogan is installing a terrible dictator. He's putting all the journalists in jail, and journalists, lawyers, and generals are in jail. So this is a complete reversal of the situation in the Middle East in the next months. Second point is about the interview of Barack Obama at the Atlantic. When you read this interview, which was carefully done during the previous weeks, when you read this interview, the President of the United States is talking like he was not at power, like he was writing his memoirs. But he said what he's thinking about his allies. So he said horrible things about Nicolas Sarkozy, David Cameron, King Salman, or President Erdogan. He said that Erdogan is a madman. So right now, the U.S. sends this message to all the allies. You have to obey now, or President Obama, in the next 9 months, will make public a lot of your dirty work in the last year. So it will be a big conflict between Washington and and his own allies in the next 9 months. If some of them refuse to obey, they will be destabilized by revelations about their own politics.
Fascinating. Thierry, very quickly, since I know you have to go, you're saying that the U.S. and Russia will arm the PKK.
Yes.
Is there also some kind of a political operation, maybe in the Turkish military or among the Turkish parties, to generate more opposition?
Yes, there is also, but since months, there is a different operation inside the militaries and inside the political parties. But inside the political parties, they were thinking they will be able to change the majority at the last general election, but Erdogan was making false results. But inside the army, there is now a big movement for the U.S. against Erdogan.
So he got in through vote fraud the last time around. This is Webster Tuffy with World Crisis Radio from Washington. I think we're still on the line, perhaps, with Thierry Masson in Damascus, Syria. Big news is that there's a deal of Obama and Putin, an accord to oust the Turkish dictator Erdogan, the caliph of the Islamic State, the main backer of the ISIS, right? Daesh, ISIL, whatever we want to call it. Thierry, I know you're pressed for time. Is there anything to add?
No, I said the most important. And you will see in the next, it will be exactly like I indicate to you.
All right, so it means also the Islamic State will collapse and they will be left with some area around Raqqa?
No. I haven't said that the Islamic State will collapse. The Islamic State will remain in the east of Syria and certainly in a part of Iraq. But it will be totally weak. But the war will go now inside Turkey. You know that already there is 3,000 or 4,000 people killed in Turkey in the last month since the general election. But nobody is talking about that. You have the tanks of the Turkish army inside some cities, and they are firing against civilian people, because now the opposition between President Erdogan and the nationalistic part inside Turkey, and on the other side, the Kurdish people, this opposition is now totally unbelievable. They will kill each other. You know, it will be a real civil war in the next years in Turkey.
All right. The other question, we had a little bit of problem with the telephone line when it came to the deal, the so-called deal today between the European Union and Turkey, right?
Yes.
This thing about the revolving door of the refugees and payments by the EU to Turkey. Can you just maybe summarize again how that fits in to this picture?
Yes, you know, the European Union is involved, the U.S. and like the Gulf countries, like the war in Syria. The result of the war is a big migration of population outside the Middle East going to Europe. So now they want to stop this migration. But President Erdogan is the only guy who is able to stop this. If they want to continue the war, they stop the war, the migration will stop immediately.
Right.
But the result is that now the European Union will pay of a euro each year to Turkey, and the European Union will be totally blocked the dictator inside Turkey, and at the same time they accelerate the negotiation of entrance of Turkey inside the European Union, and they already decide to abolish the visa for Turkish people. So this is incredible. The European Union now is financing a dictator inside Turkey.
So we've got essentially the European Union tolerating, turning a blind eye to Erdogan. They'll tolerate anything from him. And the opposition then seems to be Obama and Putin.
Yes, yes, yes.
All right. So the level of fighting in Syria and Iraq may decline, but the fighting will escalate inside Turkey.
Yes, yes. You know, you will have peace in quite all the parts habited inside Syria, except in the northeast, Raqqa, which is now the capital of the Islamic State, and Deir ez-Zor, which is at the near the Iraqi border. So in that part, it could continue during years, but we will see. You know, probably if the war began inside Turkey, this will stop the arriving of new jihadists inside Syria and Iraq, and it will be easier to finish the war in that part.
So the fighting inside Turkey will tend to interfere with the flow of supplies and recruits to Islamic State, Daesh.
Yes, yes. Right now, this war is continuing only because there is this flow of new jihadists. 2 weeks ago, you have 2,000 new jihadists entering inside Syria. 2 weeks ago. So they say this is the truth, but at the same time, the Gulf are sending new jihadists inside Syria. So the war could continue until this flow will stop, and probably the beginning of the civil war in Turkey will stop the flow.
One other point, what does Saudi Arabia have in mind for a reaction?
Really, I don't know. You have to read probably the opinion of Prince Turki, which is now not officially at power, but he was writing in the name of King Salman in a daily newspaper printed in London in English. And of course, the royal family of King Salman. And in this piece, he was answering to President Obama, saying, no, no, we are not supporting the terrorists, and we are good allies for the U.S. As you know, President Obama, before be elected to the White House when he was senator, at that time he said that the Saudi families is the worst family in the world. So, his mind. And now he's not able to reverse the Saudi family because they have built the atomic bomb. So, he must be sure to what will happen to the new weapons before reversing the Saudi family.
Before overthrowing the Saudi monarchy. Fascinating.
Yes.
Jerry, thank you so much.
Yes.
We hope you survive the winter over there. Springtime now. And we'll hope to see you next week. Thank you very much. Jerry Maison of the Voltaire Network from Damascus, Syria. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Now, we want to try again, always, to keep Trump in historical perspective. And one way you have to do that is to be aware of these party systems, right? These complexes of a general majority party, general minority party, and other things that are going on. Let me just run through a bunch of them. The first party system was from the Constitution, starting in 1788 up until 1828. Right, so the Jeffersonians were the majority party, generally speaking, although not at the beginning. The exception is so often is a war hero, George Washington, and then his immediate successor, John Adams. After that, the Federalists were washed up. And what we'd like to point to in these in this review is that when you make the transition from the previous party system to a new party system, you get the rise of these utterly unprincipled adventurers. In other words, it's like the old order, whatever that was at any given time, when that is disturbed, right, smashed, right, when it's overturned and the usual relations no longer obtain, you get these adventurers. And these adventurers are people who tend to summarize, to represent in themselves all the bad problems of the previous arrangement, and it's like a paroxysm at the end. In other words, the bad old order, the bad old days want to reassert themselves in the form of somebody like Trump, and we'll go through the various ones. Now, clearly the U.S. Constitution is born out of upheaval, right? Shays' Rebellion in Great Barrington and Pittsfield in western Massachusetts, places that I know rather well. Shays' Rebellion, of course, then meant, you know, this Articles of Confederation, weak government, it's just not going to work. So then you get our Constitution of 1788, the first Washington administration. Who is the adventurer? Who is the essentially unscrupulous criminal type who pops up? Well, it's Albert Gallatin, right? Gallatin, the evil wrecker, the saboteur, traitor, Swiss in this case, agent, who financier, right, working for London. Gallatin shows up with the Whiskey Rebellion. It's not Shays. Shays is before the Constitution. Under the Constitution, you get Gallatin and the Whiskey Rebellion. So here we have an adventurer. And essentially, this is the guy who ran Jefferson, right? Jefferson and to some extent, you know, other forces on the Jeffersonian side. A lot of them took their cues from Gallatin. He's the guy who's got his statue in front of the U.S. Treasury, facing Pennsylvania Avenue. Alexander Hamilton, who created the U.S. federal government, is relegated to the back of the Treasury building. All right. 1828, that system goes down, and you get the Jacksonian system, which is, of course, a disaster. It ends in civil war, so how could it be good? And it's marked by things like the wanton attack by Jackson and his cohorts on the Bank of the United States, the Hamilton Clay Bank of the United States. So who is the adventurer that arises there? I would say John Calhoun of South Carolina with his attempt to nullify the tariff legislation of the United States, an absolute demagogue and unprincipled adventurer. Then you get to 1860. This is the most cataclysmic of all the party realignments. This is now the beginning of, well, you've just had the collapse of the Whigs, the collapse of the Know-Nothings. And as we've said, Democratic Party splits into two parts. Constitutional Union Party appears, but thank God the Republican Party of then, many long years ago, more than a century and a half, they come on the scene, and that's Lincoln. But you see these adventurers, right, the people who, again, recapitulate the bad old days and attempt to reassert the bad old days. These are reactionaries, right? They're reacting against progress. Jefferson Davis, one of those. But the whole Confederate ruling class, right, you name it, Yancey, Toombs, Lamar, right, all bad news, right? So they're all there. 1896 is more like an adjustment inside the Republican domination. You're going from pro-Union or pro-Lincoln Republicans, at least in name, to absolute Wall Street you know, cross of gold Republicans, right? People who just, they're just representing the interests of the Chase Manhattan Bank and the rest of them, right? The House of Morgan, in effect. Now, 1932, you get the victory of Roosevelt in the beginning of the New Deal. Who's the demagogue who shows up? Huey Long, I think, is the figure, right? Now, this is an interesting figure because there are positive features, right? A lot of infrastructure gets built, but still, the goal is dictatorship. Let's not kid ourselves. And Huey Long as president would be a much different proposition than Huey Long as the dominant force inside the Louisiana political machine, right? Because this would then become megalomania and the lust for power. 1968, this is when the New Deal coalition gets smashed. Because of Lyndon Johnson's stupidity in going into the Vietnam War and trying to ram that down people's throats with drafts and, you know, 500 dead every week. Absolutely insane. We covered this week that the new arrangement, right, the Southern strategy after 1968 is the result of this deal between Richard Nixon and Strom Thurmond, the segregationist, the Dixiecrat, the neo-Confederate. They come together at the Miami Republican Convention of 1968, and the Republicans say, look, we're going to forget about civil rights. We're going to become a party of racism and dog whistles. And Thurmond says, great, then we're all going to move into the Republican Party, and the Democratic Party in the South is going to be essentially wrecked. Now, who expresses the adventurer at that point? George Wallace, Confederate himself, right? And, the you know, is obviously a power-mad person who attempts to win states, and there you see it. Now, 2008 to 2016, in reality, we should have been finished with the Southern strategy, right? The Republican Southern strategy should have been dead and buried by 2008, but because of this problem of the fecklessness of Obama plus the long-lasting effects of the Depression of 2008, which essentially then get blamed on Obama, we've got a kind of a party realignment that's stuck in the mud. It risks being stillborn, right? In other words, if Trump wins this election, you'll have a party realignment into fascism under Trump and chaos and quite possibly civil war, right? With this big yap, imagine that every day for 4 years. That's going to be awful. So Trump is the figure, the adventurer here. You have to indulge me now. The neocons always talk about the Owl of Minerva, right? Minerva, Athena, goddess of wisdom. And the quote from Hegel that these neocons all love is that the Owl of Minerva takes flight at dusk. In other words, the true nature of a system of culture and politics and institutions, the true nature is really known only when it's about to collapse. So, and you can make this comparison, except, of course, with Trump, it's not the Owl of Minerva. My God, there is no wisdom to be obtained, right? There's just all of the bad features of the old order. We joke that it's called the Owl of Priapus, given the stress on the priapic aspects of Trump that is so prominent in his campaign. So there you get it. These figures do appear. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome to our final segment. We're recording here on March 18th. So remember, do check up on that demonstration at the appearance of Trump at AIPAC in Washington, D.C. on this coming Monday. Check textwallstreetparty.us, tarpley.net, other places, my Twitter feed, certainly Webster G. Tarpley. We want to go and protest that there's a fascist who wants to be president, and he's demanding a coronation, and this is too much. This is impossible. So First Amendment lives in us and through us. So we're going to be using it on Monday. So the other one, this is one that really, I don't think anybody has noticed this, but you'll remember the coup d'etat in Moscow in August of 1991. It is the coup d'etat of the eight. In other words, there were eight officials of the Soviet regime. Prime Minister Valentin Pavlov, Kryuchkov, the Vice President of the Soviet Union, Yanayev, others, Pugo of the Interior Ministry, right? The eight, the coup d'etat of the eight. And what was their program? They said Gorbachev has wrecked this thing. He's a weak leader, kind of like Obama. And what they said was, we want to make the Soviet Union great again. Isn't that uncanny? They wanted to make the Soviet Union great again, and the manifesto of the GKCP, the State Committee on the State of Emergency, August 19th to 21st, 1991, the manifesto of their coup d'etat, the honor and dignity of Soviet man must be restored. Make the Soviet Union great again. And you can see what it is. When a form of domination, right, of internal political domination, because this was now the Soviet Union about to break up. It didn't need to, but thanks to these characters, this ultimately backfired against them. But they came forward saying, we're going to reassert the old order, and therefore we're going to have a coup. What they do, of course, is to recapitulate in themselves all of the insoluble problems that the old system cannot solve. And then express, you know, an outburst of rage or whatever it is against that. And that's what you see with Trump. He's saying, you know, we want to continue the 1968 to 2008 Southern strategy based on racism, based on scapegoating and all the rest of it. And he takes it to a new level. In other words, he escalates these old problems. He doesn't solve them. He reasserts them. So take a look at the briefing that I'm referring to here, right? The one for, let's see, March 17th, that is to say for Thursday of this week. You have a great chart that I'm very proud of with the cycles, right? 1788 to 1828. And, you know, who is the dominant party? Who's the minority party? Are there exceptions? There are usually exceptions. They're quite often war heroes, right? Say under the Jacksonians, right? Mostly Democrats, but William Henry Harrison, Tippecanoe, and Zachary Taylor as war heroes. They get in there. Similarly, 1932 to 1968, that's the New Deal FDR Democratic cycle. Republicans are a minority, but Eisenhower as a war hero wins two terms. So there are exceptions, right? And therefore, we would need to complete this party realignment by now, by 2016. This is overdue. So the Trump racist, xenophobic, and indeed fascist Republicans have got to be defeated. And we think that really this time, this Republican Party has gone so far down the road to insanity and unreality and venom and hatred and all the policies that we've talked about. It is time for this party to disappear from the page of history. And this entire international, right? If you let Trump in there, you're going to have an international with Marine Le Pen, with Beppe Grillo, with the Alternative für Deutschland, with this unfortunate woman, Frauke Petri, Farage of UKIP. This would be very, very bad news. So we have to make sure that when these forces of evil collide, say the clerical fascist cruise against the fascist Trump, that has to be a productive clash, which leads to the weakening of evil on both sides. So we love the Republican Party. We love it so much we want there to be at least two of them, and if possible, three of them, right? You can have a southern one, you can have a rural one, God knows, and then you can have the Intermountain West one, all these places of low population. So, the key thing is, polite society has got to realize that you're dealing with something called fascism, and you cannot entertain it. In other words, one of these articles talks about the shame of sticking with Trump. In other words, if you choose to support this, then you are declaring your bankruptcy. Right here we are on the Washington Post editorial page. The stain of sticking with Trump, right? That's going to be opprobrium in the future, right? It's going to be said, what? You hobnobbed with that monster, right? If he gets anywhere, he'll be showing it. And you look at Trump, right? He says, the old guy who punched the black guy in that rally, he says, it's obviously somebody who loves his country very much. What? By punching a black guy, you prove that you love the country very much? How does that follow? That does not follow at all. And then the same guy says, if he comes back, we may have to kill him. So there we have it, a lynch mob. And Trump says Trump is ready to pay the legal expenses of a lynch mob. This is a monstrosity. Now, the other thing, which I don't think we have time to do, the jurisprudence of Antonin Scalia is absolutely in the spirit of this Nixon and Strom Thurmond deal. And what we're seeing, that now that Scalia is no longer there, the situation on the high court is changing. And there are only eight of them. For example, for the first time in 10 years, Clarence Thomas said something. He opened his yap and started to defend gun rights. Right? Scalia had been the big guy on that. But now Thomas comes out of his rock. Now, the other one is Dow Chemical had been expected to argue an antitrust case. Dow Chemical now says, since Scalia is not there, they're going to settle a $1 billion antitrust judgment. And they say, growing political uncertainty due to recent events and the Supreme Court and increased likelihood for unfavorable outcomes for business involved in class action suits have changed Dow's risk assessment of the situation. So they're going to pay. They're not going to fight it because they think they may lose. It may go even worse for them. So get the idea? One reactionary loudmouth like Scalia, a fascist judge in effect. So he already has tipped the balance. And then we had, when the state of Texas came to argue for their really bad faith restrictions on abortion clinics, right? That you've got to be able to get people into a nearby hospital. So the Texas Texas Solicitor General Scott A. Keller came. He got pounded, first of all, by Sotomayor and Ginsburg, the two women, and then Stephen Breyer and Kagan came in. So four of them were pounding the Texas representative. Things have actually changed. We'll talk about why this Merrick Garland was a bad idea. He called for a black woman. Merrick Garland is none of that. He's not going to have the right political effect. Chose the weakness of Obama, but we're going to be soldiering on. See you next week on World Crisis Radio.